sentient beings may attain Buddhahood. From my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. Whatever the virtues of the many fields of knowledge, all are steps on the path to omniscience. May these arise in the clear mirror of intellect. O Manjushri, please accomplish this. Hi, good evening.
Good evening.
Welcome back from your Thanksgiving feast. So tonight we go further on Vipassana. Let's focus tonight on. I think it makes sense to go through first Rinpoche's presentation of Vipassana in talk 8 and 9 of the 1973 seminary, and then we'll go back and look at the presentation of Vipassana. The progression of it as the bodhicitta slogans. How's that? Is that okay? And so it came up over the holiday that when you mix mind with space, like how much mind and how much space, what's the proper mixture? And then the question is space then like a Is that space like claustrophobic space? Or can it be claustrophobic space that you mix your mind with? Or can it be too spacious, just like really spaced out, just be really spaced out? Any sense of that, you know, when you mix mind with space in practice? Do you experience those differences, like going out and just like spacing out?
Yes.
Or going out and then you're still like really like involved in the thoughts and the chaos of the thoughts and the going out and dissolving is like sort of like a conceptual thing.
Both.
You like going through the motions sort of? Like following the technique.
Yeah.
Really doing
it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, so, would that be like viewing space as being accommodating or obstructing, or like friendly or unfriendly?
Unfriendly.
Unfriendly in that case, right? Space arising as like an irritant,
or
something
an
you can't, an escape, something you can't get to really. And then when you space out completely, then what is it, like quicksand or something?
Fog.
Fog. Mushiness. Would that be space like arising as a friend when you're like able to really, when you go out and you dissolve out into space and then you haven't shifted out of space, but then you continue to be present. some skeptical looks here.
Listen, that's the goal, right? The last of these.
That is, isn't it? Yeah. What? So, how do you view the progression? Is the progression shamatha vipassana, and then vipassana, or is it shamatha Vipassana and then shamatha vipassana?
Second one?
What was the second one? Shamatha?
Vipassana.
Shamatha vipassana. And then full vipassana.
Yeah.
That's the progression?
Resting Vipassana at the end.
Resting Vipassana at the end. Any other thoughts?
Sputtering out.
Oh, thank you, Peter. Both at the same time.
Yeah, you ever sharpen a knife on like a wet stand?
No, but
you're
okay.
You're in one side and the next side, and you go back, and then it's like by going back and forth, the knife gets sharper.
Yeah, okay, so that means what? Shamatha then?
It means shamatha, but it means simultaneously. But like with like erring on one side of the knife.
Like, who's on one side, Aaron?
I'm going to trim us down. I don't know. What are we going to do?
It's going to be cut behind. It. Yeah, it's perfect. Yeah.
It looks nice. just move it a little bit away from the scarf.
Yeah.
Just in case like a big wind comes up.
Oh, it's sort of. Bad.
I saw that once. Did you ever see that?
Really?
Oh, God. Okay. Thank you. Yeah, where the kata caught on fire.
Yeah.
From the candle. But there was a teacher teaching there. No.
Yeah, the monks jumped up and grabbed it. And yeah. What did they do with it? Put it in saffron water or something?
I think just shook it or something. I can't.
Was it in front of a wrathful
day? I think it was on Christmas Day. Anyway, okay, so as we dive into this, remember to think about, you know, the range of Vipassana that we've been presented with, where from day one, we talk about Vipassana as what? Panoramic awareness, right? Being able to, like, sense where you are in space and where things are, and people can't sneak up on you anymore or play tricks, right? Because you're totally... like 360 degrees omniscient, right?
Well, there's the great metaphor of carrying the spoon of water in a crowd.
Yeah, do people know that? So go on, what's that metaphor, John?
So it's carrying a spoon of water, which is mindfulness, in a big crowd, so awareness of the space. And then the part I never understood was, I think he added a thing about wearing a clown outfit. Did you hear that?
Yes. So feeling very self-conscious. Hyper-like conscious.
Yeah.
There's different versions of that. Traditionally, one version is that you're holding a spoonful of hot oil, and you have to walk from one side of the room to the other, and if you spill even the tiniest bit of it, there's a guy standing behind you, a gladiator with a big sword, he's going to cut your head off immediately. And then there's also, I think, Rinpoche's version, another of his versions was, you have a red wine, and there's a white carpet, and you're at a cocktail party, and there's people like milling about all over you, so you have to be intently focused on this red wine in your spoon, but not so much that your hands shake. You know, if you concentrate too hard, it's like, you know. And then you also have to be aware of like where people are moving so they don't bump into you and spill on the carpet, right? Anyway, so there's that panoramic awareness, and then there's Vipassana as it's defined in Kongshol's text. Vipassana is what?
Discrimination
and analyzing. But they give a definition, right? Rinpoche gives a definition, right? Here, in page... okay, so you're going to have to help me today because I traveled over the holiday and I took a printout, so I don't have the source book page. So, what is chapter 8, the first page is 170? 170. So on 170, he says... he gives two definitions. First definition, Lok Chong is clear seen, perfectly seen. And then he says, Lok Chong, we'll dive into it in a minute, but that's general definition is clear seen. And we had in Kongshol, we had, let's see, 48 to 54. Kongshol's definition is... Thank you. beginning, right? He defines them. Vipassana is individual analysis, discrimination, right? Individual analysis which fully discriminates phenomena. So I'm on page 37. Shamatha and Vipassana respectively as resting the mind in mind is Shamatha on 37, the first quote from Vasubandhu's commentary. And then fully discriminating phenomena on the basis of perfect samadhi is Vipassana, presumably. And then let's see, Kamala Shila says, having calm distractions, one abides in a state of which is supple, pliant, Shenzhong, and delights. 37. And delights in focusing inward continuously, naturally. This is Shamatha. And then this is called Shamatha. While focused on this calm, abiding mind, one thoroughly analyzes its suchness. But that is called Vipassana. So analyzing or seeing suchness. Control in the paragraph after the root verse. Having calm distraction, one completely abides, and the superior nature is seen with the eyes of wisdom. And then he gives the etymological definition of Shamatha, and skipping ahead, it goes to Vipassana. He says in the word Vishesha Pashyana, Vishesha means superior, special, and Pashyana means seen. So Vishesha Pashyana means superior seeing. Hence it is called the seeing that one sees the superior, the nature of phenomena. So here the emphasis is not on panoramic wisdom, but is on seeing the true nature, suchness, emptiness, right? That's the more traditional version.
But what's more, which is saying that panoramic awareness leads to seeing.
Okay, so I think we're all agreeing on that, that panoramic awareness leads to clear seeing, leads to superior seeing. So does that mean that panoramic awareness is superior seeing, or that they're different?
Different.
Splitting here. It's different, but anyway. So back up. So remember that we have this range of Vipassana, how Vipassana is described. And also we saw Vipassana as being of two types. There's resting Vipassana, and then there's analytical Vipassana. Right? Okay, so coming back to Rinpoche's version, which I've now lost. Here we go. Page 170, right? So, clear seeing. He says there's two types. Lakdom could be regarded as a meditative practice or a contemplative practice. So those are what he's calling two types of Vipassana. A meditative practice or a contemplative type. The first one is called Jagong. So here he's giving the traditional classification of Vipassana using the Tibetan terms, which means contemplation on a certain aspect of the meaning of reality and meditating upon it. So that's the analytical version. Jagong. Gom is the word to familiarize or meditate. And Che means analysis or analyze. Or discriminate, so to meditate with discrimination, something like that. The other type is called joke gom, which means simply to rest, and meditating on the abstract or intuitive level. So there are these two types of meditations, particularly involved with Lakdong. So one is a conceptual, more conceptual, intellectual type of Vipassana, analytical, and the other is more of an intuitive, non-analytical, non-conceptual Vipassana. Then there's Lakdong Dakme Tokpe Sherep, which is, he puts it together, he says, knowledge of egoless understanding, which is equated with the idea of discriminating awareness, wisdom, which is a translation of what Sanskrit term?
Egoless understanding?
Sanskrit.
Shunya?
No. Discriminating awareness, wisdom.
Prajna.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi. So wisdom.
Yeah, not the object, the subject. Whenever we begin with the idea of Vipassana, there's a sense that we are including intellectual as well as intuitive knowledge in the teaching, bringing them together. So I'm on the third full paragraph right on this page. So I thought we could go through these two talks carefully and see how he presents Vipassana, if that's okay. Vipassana practice is not purely sitting meditation practice alone. It has the scope of pre-prajna, intellectual discriminating knowledge or awareness, wisdom. We could say that infant prajna or embryonic prajna is loktong. So loktong vipassana leads to true prajna. So it itself is embryonic or pre-prajna.
Is prajna understood as a post-meditation facility?
Not necessarily. Vipassana, he describes Vipassana often as a post-meditation experience, which is also a little bit confusing. Because no, the traditionally that's not described that way at all. His explanation of Vipassana as panoramic awareness, he says, happens more in the post-meditation state. So we're on page 170, what are we on? Close. 370? What page are we on?
170.
One of the definitions of Vipassana, Loktong, is the flame that burns the fuel of the conceptual ego mind. The flame that burns the fuel of conceptual ego mind. So it's that energy that destroys ego, destroys the conceptualizing process of ego.
But Derek, before you said the two kinds of Vipassana, one was conceptual.
Yes.
So is this a different kind of conceptual? Is ego conceptual and non-ego conceptual?
Let's see. Does he give the full quote? The statement of that definition of Vipassana comes from the Kashyapa Sutra, where the Buddha says, in Vipassana meditation, we use conceptual mind to burn up conceptual mind. And it's like using kindling or firewood to create a fire, and then once that fire is going, it burns up all the kindling. But initially, you need the kindling, the wood, to create the fire itself. So we use concepts in that same way, where we use conceptual mind to then create this fire of prajna that then burns up the conceptuality.
But that thing, it doesn't seem like all concepts are ego-oriented. I mean, right?
Not necessarily. Some concepts lead to ego destruction.
Right.
Right, so they're saying conceptuality has a positive quality.
Is that what we call intellect, then?
Prajna.
Prajna, okay.
Yeah. Intellect in English has a whole range of meanings. But discriminating awareness, or discriminating intellect, or discriminating, investigating, those two qualities of conceptual mind can lead to conceptual mind dissolving itself. Come to the point where you get further and further refinement on what conceptuality is, where conceptuality is created, where do we hold conceptuality, what do we project conceptuality onto, and that can, by investigating that over and over again, discriminating very carefully, using those two phases that that Kongtrul described, of discriminating things into categories. So looking at your experience, like they give the five skandhas, the six the 12 ayatanas, and the 18 dhatus as the main scheme for breaking down your experience, where normally we have this sense of continuity of experience, of wholeness of experience. And so first step is to break down your experience into, oh, there's a subject and an object, and it's an eye sense faculty, and a sense and a visual form, and it's producing a visual consciousness to break things down in that way. So discriminating the normal feeling of there being this continuous or unitary experience, breaking that down into parts, and then looking at those parts and saying, to what extent do those parts exist independently of the other parts, or can they? Are they truly existent? Are they interdependently arisen? Are they a conceptual projection, or are they beyond a conceptual? You know, that whole framework. And ultimately it revolves down to understanding, experiencing the conceptual projection that we place over the world, over our experience all the time. Where we're constantly, every moment of cognition, we open our eyes or we wake up or we turn our attention back from spacing out, and then we recreate our conceptual projection of being a human being in a room with other people, and there being walls, and so on and so forth. And then we hold that projection all the time. We keep maintaining that projection. And so seeing where that projection is, seeing where what's holding that projection by constantly looking at the subject-object quality of it. What's the subject side of this projection? Where is the subject that's holding this structure of a framework of a room full of people? And what is the actual object? What is the actual object of our visual consciousness? Does our eye see people? Mm-hmm. Yes? My eyes aren't seeing people. My eyes see colors. Right? People is the projection. We make this assumption that, oh, there's an assemblage of colors in a particular arrangement, and that must be a person. And a person is a conceptual fabrication, right? You can't see a person. You can't touch a person. You can't know any persons. Anyway, we digress.
Okay. Not at all.
Personally, let me send you some guidelines as to how to relate with these subjects. So he gives this neat little excursus, whatever. He goes into this sort of traditional way of presenting Dharma, which like you find in Genpopa's Jewel Ornament. When you read that, when he goes through every topic, he says there's the definition, there's the essence, there's the divisions of it, there's classifications of it, which are different, and then there's how to generate it, and the stages of that, and then the perfection of it. You know, and he has this standard framework that, like every chapter, he does that at the beginning. Anyway,
and that comes from where? That's obviously from tradition.
Yeah, that's from tradition. I don't know
but
who started
no specific, it. That's not like one of those where he was bringing it straight from a particular text.
No, I think that just became a standard way of doing it over time. I don't know that you can credit anybody with that. George.
Himself.
Mary, I think Mary. Traditionally, the definition. So first there's a definition and given in both in terms of an example, imagery. And from that, there's categories of different types of subjects that contain different qualities and attributes. Or more likely, after that, there's categories of different qualities. The definition of Loktong is that which burns the ego mind. So to what sense does panoramic awareness burn ego mind? To what sense does discriminating awareness burn ego mind? That is the basic statement of what it's all about. Therefore, it'd be a misunderstanding to regard Vipassana as a technique in meditation practice after shamatha alone. It is something more than that. It's sort of the result of the technique, as opposed to being just the technique, which is with shamatha is more like the technique, and Vipassana implies the result. It's been said that Longtong is that which brings together knowledge and the meditative state of mind. Intellect and intuition, prajna and samadhi. That which brings them together is the Longtong experience of clear thinking and complete awareness. Similar panoramic. Thus far, when we've been discussing the Vipassana aspect of the practice, any kind of awareness that we practice is more mindfulness than awareness. Did I read that right?
Yeah.
Awareness is more mindfulness than awareness.
It's not always totally clear, obviously, what he's talking about. But, remember that in the system of shamatha, there's this thing, there's two qualities of shamatha. There's trempa, mindfulness, and then there's shesha, clear knowing, or presently knowing, right? And Rinpoche presents, which I think we went through, the combination of the trenche, right? He truncates the Tibetan words. Trenpa, mindfulness, recollection, and sheshen, presently knowing, or clear knowing. And so that's traditionally an aspect of mindfulness, of shamatha. Traditionally, shamatha has these two main qualities, mindfulness and awareness. Now, we saw in the Satipatthana Sutra, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness Sutra, that in the refrain, the Buddha says, ardent, clearly comprehending, and mindful, over and over and over again, right? So those three things are really the main qualities of shamatha practice. And so basically what it seems like, to come to the cut to the chase, is that it seems like what Rinpoche does is he uses awareness to bridge two things, to bridge the sheshen quality of shamatha and awareness to indicate the non-conceptual part of Vipassana practice. Does that make sense? That awareness spans those two. And the panoramic awareness is somewhere along that spectrum, where the presently knowing in shamatha is more of like is like the watcher that we give rise to early on in the practice, that's keeping track of our meditation. Are we on the object? Oh, I drifted off. You know, it arises when you notice that you drifted off. There's a flash of recognition, and then the watcher says, "Oh, I've been drifting. I have to come back." Right?
I thought the one that sees that you've drifted off is the awareness part, or is that the sheshen part?
That's the sheshen part, and in that case, we use awareness to mean sheshen. So right. Basically, the word awareness turns out to be very broadly applied and easily misunderstood, because he's applying it to many different things. So, to support my case, we'll see a number of different presentations where he talks about Vipassana and panoramic awareness and how those relate. But keep that in mind. That's sort of interesting, I guess.
It seems like in some later parts or some other parts he's talking about awareness. I'm trying to make that distinction where as long as there's still someone being aware, that's not really the awareness. That's back to sort of shamatha level mindfulness. And so that was in some other reading, not this particular section. I think that's a later one.
Mm. Maybe when we went through the Profound Treasury, the different volumes, that was.
Or it might be one of the next ones, I'm not sure.
We'll go through readings from The Path is the Goal, that book, where he talks a bunch about Vipassana. He clarifies this there. Anyway, so it appears that he's saying any kind of awareness that we practice in. Let's see, when we have discussed the Vipassana aspect of the practice of meditation, any kind of awareness that we practice is more mindfulness than awareness. It seems to me he's sort of saying, I've been talking about that sheshen quality of shamatha, really, that quality that goes along with mindfulness. And then he describes it. the sense of being there, and the sense of bare attention to what's happening psychologically, physically, emotionally, whatever, fully being there. Those are all mindfulness practices, i.e. mindfulness awareness practices. But from Vipassana practice onward, any kind of meditative experience, meditative concentration that we might use is regarded as awareness practice, being aware rather than being mindful. So he's saying that this quality of awareness transforms when we actually experience Vipassana from being that clear, present knowing, that keeping track quality of awareness in shamatha, to something very different in Vipassana. Let's see how he describes what the different animal is. The definition of mindfulness, absolute, ideal mindfulness. Wow, here it is. But he gives an image, right? It's like a burning candle uninterrupted by wind. There's a sense of stillness and a sense of ongoing accuracy. Everything is noted, perceived, and everything is recycled, so to speak. What does it mean, recycled here? Any ideas? Like the air in the room, you keep breathing the same air over again or something?
Well, I think the next thing that he says sort of is referring to it. I mean, I think it's sort of a further elaboration on that, because where he says you're not looking for external things to reinforce. So it's kind of like recycling, almost like reusing what's going on in your experience.
Yeah, I think so. Just constantly rehashing your existing mental baggage, your existing mental framework, your psychological makeup, and your physical makeup.
Sounds really depressing.
Okay. The practitioner is not looking for external material to reinforce the effort, or the methods that he applies to the practice. Rather than getting a supply from outside, it is self-contained. Therefore, it's like a candle burning, undisturbed by the wind, self-contained. It's being mindful and relating with the eight types of consciousness and just simply being there precisely.
That makes it sound not quite as bad, right?
Yeah, it's better that way.
Also, this sense of mind not going anywhere, like mind can't actually go anywhere. That, you know, the feeling of getting lost and drifting away is actually an illusory feeling, because you're always right here. In the case of locked-tone practice, it becomes slightly more adventurous, because now we begin to include the intellectual aspect in our psychological makeup. The clear seeing begins to bring about a sense of relationship. The intellectual messenger, the conceptualizer, begins to become active and begins to develop discriminating awareness. So in shamatha, we're constantly told to dismiss whatever thoughts arise. Just label them and let go of them. And then gradually, as we stabilize in shamatha practice, there's more of a sense of beginning to explore the psychological baggage that we have, what the content of it, and then how, and the patterns of it. You know, he talks about, relationship, the relationship quality. How do things... how does one thing lead to another thing? How do they compare? How are they connected? We should be careful about that particular term or idea of discriminating. It's not discriminating in the sense of throwing away or rejecting certain things, like racial discrimination, which is the idea of rejecting what is seen to be inferior as opposed to the superior. In this case, when we talk about discriminating, it means that everything is seen precisely, clearly, and nothing is rejected. So it's discriminating in the sense of separating dharmas. Where does mind begin and end, and where does body begin and end? Where does the visual subject begin? Where does the visual object begin? Where does our consciousness go from a visual experience to then a conceptual associative interpretation of that experience, projecting the thought of persons onto an assemblage of colors and so forth. everything is seen clearly, precisely, and nothing rejected. Everything is included, but not in a vague, happy together way, the ordinary notion of an ecumenical spirit. Everything is included, but on its own merit, whether it's worthy or unworthy, etc. Everything is seen clearly. At the same time, they have their names, their categories, and their concepts. So it is involved. It's experiencing its own conceptualizing, labeling process. We're exploring that whole way that we conceptualize, as I tried to describe earlier. Everything is placed very clearly and fully so that things become very precise. And that is why the idea of bringing together prajna and samadhi is the characteristic of Lakhtam. There you go. So the example of Lakhtam is like a flame burning fuel, the knowledge and the clarity burning the fuel of ego mind. Characteristic. So he gave definition earlier, now he gave example, now he's given the characteristic. It's the combination of knowledge and the meditative state. So it was where, instead of knowledge or intellect being completely discursive and hopping around, having no stability, having no clarity, having no strength, it's joined with the meditative state or experience or development of shamatha. So it has a stability and a strength and a precision to it. We might ask, how come there is a meditative state if the whole thing is entirely based on discrimination awareness principle, which is busy labeling and trying to pinpoint things? The basic notion of the meditative state of Lakhtam is the sense of vastness, the sense of spaciousness, because you no longer have to be mindful, but you can be aware. So there's not as much like project-oriented activity, or effort, or agenda-oriented activity. Because this type of awareness is more of a reflexive, passive, receptive quality of mind, as opposed to the type of awareness in shamatha where you're keeping track. Am I doing the technique? Did I think of that before? Do I have to think about that again? So we could say that mindfulness is a journey from the outskirts to the central point. In mindfulness practice, you find mental activities, whatever, and you begin to note the mental contents as being accurate. And then you focus your attention and you begin to develop a sense of well-being by observing, seeing things as they are in their own life, which is a journey. So that was a very interesting presentation. So there's a journey from the outskirts to the central point. He describes that whole journey of mindfulness practice. Noting the, you identify mental activities, you note them and their activity, and then you focus on parts of it, you focus your attention, and then by being present with whatever's happening, it naturally develops the sense of well-being by observing, by seeing things as they are in that simplistic way. So you made a journey from the sort of discursive quality of mental activity to being in a very settled place of experiencing your mental activity. However, in the case of awareness practice of Lakhtam, it is direct in the sense that it does not take a journey or preparation to find the subject matter. So it's not like you have to do this whole process of connecting with your mental activity and stabilizing it and then experiencing it from a stable place. The awareness practice goes the other way. It doesn't necessarily demand putting your effort into it at all. You just perceive things simply, directly, whether you perceive mental contents or whatever. That perception itself is the expression of Lakhtam. So it has that instantaneous quality and that relaxed quality of letting go of the project, of the activity. And then the perception or the quality of awareness comes to you. We could say quite safely, as has been said by Tarnata and so forth, that Laktong is like riding an elephant. You think you're riding the elephant, but in fact the elephant is carrying you. So there is a sense of Laktong coming upon you rather than you working towards it. It does not need cooking up, so to speak. So this is one of the main things that he talks about in many places, is this idea, this sense of Vipassana awareness comes at you when you stop, like when you're not totally lost in preoccupation, which is our normal framework, and when you're not also fixated in the way that shamatha is, where you have this project of bringing yourself into the present. When once you gradually, as you have developed the ability to be in the present, and it's not a struggle to be in the present, then you can actually sort of enjoy that and relax in that and let go of the project. And then this sort of larger field appears.
The reason you're not in the present is because you have an idea of what the present is.
One of many, many ideas.
Yeah. I mean, you are in the present, whether you like it or not.
Yes.
So that kind, that relates to the discussion about the at-breath. Yeah, you're not so very different style of practice where you're so busy in a way
with doing that, both the in-breath and the out-breath, right?
That nothing else can happen. The out-breath sort of gives you the opportunity.
Yeah, the out-breath is like every breath, it's like pushing you into that space where you start with a precise, focused mindfulness, and then you sort of naturally try to let go of it and stay present at the same time. You're habituating yourself to seeing where your boundary is. You know, how far can I go out before I just get distracted and it turns into vagueness, or where the only way I can remain present is to also feel the in breath and have a continuous occupation. So that technique is really brilliant way of naturally bringing us into this experience.
But the technique says explicitly go out, and then here it says it's Vipassana is not a journey back out. So that can at first be a little befuddling. I don't know if that's because that's what I thought of. He's saying, because in one sense he's saying go out with the breath, every breath. But then here it's like there's no journey out.
But go out with the breath is the shamatha instruction.
Well, I think that's kind of the question of the whole course is what do we mean by mixing mind with space?
Yeah,
is that
so,
just a,
No, so where does it happen in the, you know, be very literal about the technique. Where does it happen in that, in the technique, mixing mind with space?
Well, I think there's different ways. You know, because sometimes going out is sort of bringing you into mixing mind with space. But on the other hand, when you have gone out and then you have no instruction there, then you're in gap, so that's even more mixing mind with space from that point of view. On one hand, you could say that's re-centralizing, but if you're not actually attending to it, then really that's also space.
So you're introduced to it by the technique. You go out and you have this precise focused attention on the breath, and then you go out into space. And space as an object is not something that you can hold as an object, right? So this idea of being placing your attention on space automatically disperses the sense of attention. And until you're habituated with that, the things that happen are, you know, all the thoughts get released. You go through the waterfall stage of like, I don't have anything to do, and so I'm going to drum up everything I've ever thought about in my entire life. So we go through that for a few years, you know. And then, and then I think, as you're implying, that at some point, you're able to go out into the space and continue to be precisely present in the space. And then gradually you begin to see the space during the out-breath as well. It's like you don't leave that space. You don't close back down to the when you have the out-breath. And so then the space becomes, at that point, like the space is coming to you. It's like you've given up the project and the space is there the whole time.
Doesn't he say later something about being breathed?
Right. It's like the breath is happening to you.
Yeah.
It's like that, similar to that sense of apasana coming to you. Initially, we like feel like we're doing the breath. You know, when you're meditating, when you're there, you know, then you space out, and obviously, you're still breathing.
Yeah, because you already did.
Thank goodness for this. Thank goodness for, what do they call them, autonomic?
Nervous sympathetic nervous system. Let's see. All my buddies from the past try to make the point of the superiority of Lakshong by saying that it sows the seed of the highest intelligence in our state of mind. It awakens the intelligence to realize the literal interpretation of the Dharma is no longer important. The real interpretation of the Dharma becomes more important. The non-literal, the nitarta, the ultimate meaning of the Dharma. So we don't get hung up on the literalness of the categories, but we see the profounder implication that the categories of Dharma point to. So one of the big points, what he's sort of getting at, is that traditionally Vipassana is seen as the dividing line between Buddhists and non-Buddhists, where we share shamatha with non-Buddhists. It's a common practice among, you know, most religions, if not all religions, have some sense of shamatha, prayer or whatever. But Vipassana is a uniquely Buddhist activity, theoretically.
Like a Buddhist trope. Like, this is the thing that separates us.
Territory. And so the Dharma is not purely technical and doctrinal anymore. You know, we can when we experience the rote lists, it's no longer like just a repeating like a litany of, you know, the four noble this, the three that. One begins to realize the essence of Dharma can be felt rather than simplistically memorizing ideas and categories within books in a technical scholarly way. So it's similar to the process of learning about the Dharma and all the different categories and schemes, and at some point them coming together and like realizing the connections and how things define each other and describe each other and expand upon each other is similar to that sense of Vipassana coming to you. It's like the deeper meaning of the Dharma sort of dawns to you in that, because you're sort of accessing this non-conceptual area of our existence. From that point of view, it's that which awakens the intuitive understanding. Without it, Lakshong or Vipassana, there's no way we can prepare ourselves to understand the comprehend the subtleties of the teachings. And so Lakshong practice goes from Hinayana up to Mahayana, Mahāati level of Vajrayana, and it's the most important thing since sliced bread. There are several attributes, largely based on intellectual sharpness, developed by the first practicing Vipassana meditation. Intellectual sharpness, rather than on meditative experience itself. Whenever he says meditative experience, he's talking about shamatha, samadhi type meditation. The first one is relying more on the sense of the teachings than on the work. Any idea what this list that he's going through?
But it's not the four reliances. It starts out something like that, but it's not.
No, but it's the six discoveries that we went through quickly, like a couple of weeks ago, I believe, right?
Yeah.
But he gives a different number. He gives seven, right? Mm-hmm. So, what's happening is that... What is happening? Do you hear that? Someone's calling. He's calling. He's like, Anyway, so he goes through these six qualities, which we don't really need to go through again.
They're weird, aren't they?
Yeah. So skipping to the next page, those are the results of the clear thinking of Lakshan Vipassana, the process which sees precisely and clearly. Okay, so let's skip to the next page, which is source text, page 95. What page are the source? 174, okay. So I think he references the stages of Vipassana practice, which we'll go through again later, I think, in more detail. The first level of Lakthong is called the practice of the infant. That is the awareness technique which we probably should discuss tomorrow. Practice of the infant is at the level of the first path or the path of accumulation. We begin from that level. So Vipassana beginning right from the beginning of the path, the first of the five paths. That is to say that a person is just about to commit himself into his own intellect. An interesting way of saying something. He no longer throws away his intellect as being an obstacle, but we begin to make a relationship with our intellect for the first time, having gone through the shamatic experience of precision and sense of well-being, mindfulness, and so forth. What we discussed today includes the idea of the practice of the infant and also the higher practice of developing discriminating wisdom. And the general notion is that starting on Vipassana experience is definitely a much bigger step than shamatha. In fact, it's closer to the basic sanity of Buddhism than general spiritual practice. Definitely, clearly stating that now we have gone through our basic mental training and are ready to launch ourselves into the next area of cutting through ego or egolessness. So Vipassana is seen as this process of experiencing egolessness, cutting through ego. Some interesting stuff in the Q&A. Next page, 175. Second question. Basically asking, like, where's this practice going on among the eight consciousnesses, right? Mm-hmm. He says, no, I think actually Lakthong traditionally is supposed to operate on the level of the self and consciousness completely. That's pretty interesting, huh?
Yeah.
Where does shamatha operate?
Sixth.
I would think the sixth or the first six. So what's the seventh one called?
Ego
consciousness. Right, so Vipassana is cutting through ego, so that's where Vipassana is operating on the seventh consciousness. And that's why it's very powerful. It cuts the underlying confused dualistic notions, discriminating notions, and introduces clear, superior dualistic notions. Is that what that said? Better notions. Okay, so next one on the page 176, is it? Next page. Second question on the page. What is the difference between mindfulness and awareness? Oh, great question. Help me out here. Does awareness simply see more than mindfulness, or does it in fact begin to see things differently? So does it see different things, or does it say the same things differently? See the same. Mindfulness is limited and has the quality of waiting for something. Expectancy. He's talked about this in other places, that mindfulness is like you're waiting.
You skipped over one, when you skipped over one paragraph a couple pages ago, it was the paragraph about no goal. That was one of the key points about Vipassana, was about no goal.
Cool. Thank you for mentioning that. So no expectancy. Letting go of the expectancy. Thank you. It involves very subtle expectation, and awareness is almost one shot. It doesn't have to wait for anything, but it's being at that point on the spot, implying that the mindfulness, that waiting expectancy, is not a one-shot. It's like you're doing something throughout a period of time, as if like you're moving towards something. You're like, it's that journey quality, as opposed to awareness is just you're there.
You keep coming back too in mindfulness, right?
Make that journey all the way back. Keep coming, right. So does that mean in Vipassana you don't come back anymore?
Never leave.
Smart one, okay. Never leave home again. Let's see.
Doesn't the world bring you back, or whatever you want to call it, bring you back, rather than you're coming back?
There's like nowhere to go.
Yeah.
Recycling.
Yeah. You have to separate.
So here he answers what the shamatha works on, which consciousness is another couple of things down on the page. It says the sense consciousnesses are what you work with in the shamatha practice. Let's see. So a couple of more pages. I've lost my page. One. I'm on 99 of the sources. Is that 177? 178. Okay. Oh, this is a really neat description of like the whole technique of why in Buddhism do we like study like all these advanced teachings and stages of the path and everything and all the stages of experience and fruition, instead of just like focusing on the practice, you know, and getting there. And he says, so it's the second response, R for response, right? He says in the third sentence, nothing is particularly held back. All the aspects, all the attributes of the experience are given to the practitioner right at the beginning, the definitions and how those ideas should occur to you. Everything's given to you so that you would no longer expect any kind of mystery. You know everything back to front, and that exhausts your expectation of anything extraordinary. So if you don't explain all that stuff, then it's still out there like, oh, what's in that chapter? What's down the road? More of the same.
What's interesting is that little discussion after that about the question of whether by being told all that one should be looking for it or recognizing it along the way, and it's sort of a very subtle thing the way he just keeps kind of dismissing that notion, because you know people keep thinking you're telling me this, it's got to be a reason that I'm supposed to notice the milestones, you know?
Yeah, I'm going to become obsessed with where am I?
What is that?
When is it going
to
happen?
Am I supposed to, you know, recognize everything you've told me?
So what's it said?
Well, really not. I mean, it seems it's just...
And so where are we in the terms of the yanas at this point? Hinayana, right?
Yeah.
Okay, good. And then, let's see, page 101.
There you go.
If we're talking about there's no secrecy at all, we are most assuredly not in the Vajrayana.
Thank you. Good point.
So, yeah, the way he describes how you deal with all this, it's just attributes, and there's no reason to be excited about
right.
these things particularly. You are in the state of Lodtan, and so what? So what?
Okay, so let's move on to talk 9, I think. Comparison. Talk 9 is page 186. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Okay. Today we're going to discuss the notion of lockdown in terms of actual meditation practice. as opposed to yesterday, what we were talking more, the types, the categories, and stuff, I guess. But before we get into that, let me further clarify the attitude towards shamatha vipassana. Shamatha practice could be regarded as a way of quieting, pacifying the mind, whereas vipassana could be regarded as a way of sharpening the potentials of psychological development. How do you like that phrase? Sharpening the potentials of psychological development. Is that prajna? Is that a description of the gloss of prajna? Shamatha is regarded as a cutting down process in a way that gives you very little reference point, very little stuff to work on except its own ground, slowly cutting into what is basically needed in order to quiet oneself. Shamatha is therefore development of peace. As far as vipassana is concerned, having already quietened, having already developed some basic work, one would be able to settle into what one has already practiced or created, settle into what one has achieved. Then we can expand from that level. So the settling in, I think, is more like the culmination of shamatha. That shamatha, you settle in to being present. And then vipassana is, we could expand from that level, extending ourselves into sharpening awareness rather than continuing to cut down mental perceptions. So it's an entirely different approach at this point. So from that point of view, vipassana is referred to as insight and is also the seed of prajna at the same time. So often people ask, and you're supposed to ask at this point, like, so does this mean that I don't have to label my thoughts and let go of them immediately and come back?
Is that cutting down?
Which?
The labeling is cutting them down.
Right. So does this mean now I can get into my thoughts?
No.
Oh, darn, no.
Sorry.
So what does it mean then? How is it different?
You just let them be.
You have to cut them
down. You transform them. You don't just notice.
What are you transforming
it? You don't get hooked by them, they're just there.
Okay.
No right answer.
Although in some cases you were talking about, sometimes there's investigating in vipassana also. So there's different aspects to it.
From that point of view, pasana is referred to as insight and also as the seat of prajna, which means preparing ourselves so we become worthy of listening and hearing the teachings and perceive the subtleties. And that is why vipassana becomes an important practice. It's the start of opening the door of wisdom, the gate of wisdom. Any contemplative approach toward the teaching is also included in vipassana practice. So, when does vipassana begin on the path? At the culmination of shamatha? When do we begin vipassana practice?
When it hurt happens.
Whenever that practice.
At some point.
Any contemplative practice.
It just happens.
The contemplative practice. When does that happen? In one's exposure to Buddhism.
Meditation.
When does vipassana
come?
When does the contemplative approach toward any contemplative approach toward the teachings?
Get that right away.
From the first moment,
yes.
Right? When you're presented with what is meditation or what is Buddhism, you're starting to think about what is enlightenment? What is a Buddha? What is meditation? What is it supposed to do to me? What am I supposed to get out of? All of that is vipassana. All that whole process of trying to understand the Dharma from the very first moment that it dawns in your mind, vipassana, right? That contemplation. So vipassana has that whole span of, reading about it, thinking about it, talking about it, to actual more formal practice on the cushion where you're experiencing that open space where you can then see the patterns of your mind and so forth.
I think that would be the difference between receiving the meditation technique here and at some mindfulness parlor.
We're
not getting all the other. No, this is something that came up. before, because we're being given all this vipassana, all these words and books to read, and this view, with the exact same technique, maybe.
Yeah.
But from the beginning, we are getting all this view.
Right. There's a whole envelope of much larger context.
But I could give, or you could give the exact same breathing instruction
to people
without that, and it could still, and that's done.
Right. And walk away, and they would have totally different impact.
So is the Vipassana instruction in some way like an informal thing, or is just done through providing the view?
It's both. It's both that as well as the formal, more formal application in the practice. But it goes back to this whole idea that the view is so important in our path, that without even like knowing it, what we're doing, we're starting with a view when we come to a place like here, where we give a talk and explain like the Dharma, talk about the Dharma. You read a book. You're encouraged to do that whole exploratory process, as opposed to like it being like going to the gym. And okay, I'm going to go and put in my 23 minutes of mental exercise.
But Rinpoche never gave any formal Vipassana techniques.
What about where he says the technique of Vipassana is just like the third application of mindfulness? Didn't we read that recently?
You mean effort, I believe?
Yeah. Didn't we come across that a couple of weeks ago?
I think so.
It's hard, you take a week off and like everything's...
But it's interesting that often, it's not as solid at all. And it's often the case that people will be practicing a while, and then at some point they sort of hear about Vipassana, and they start to kind of go, well, when does Vipassana come? When does that, when they try to start to figure out what it is? Like, if you're working as...
It used to be that Vipassana technique was only like talked about in meditation and structure.
Right, and that's the context I'm thinking, is that people would start asking you, like, so where does Vipassana come?
Yeah.
And so that's what I mean, but your thinking is sort of subtle, right?
It's very individual.
Yeah. And the question, what is it even,
Right.
And so what you're saying in this case, it's sort of interesting because it's been there all along, as opposed to being, in some cases, the storyline is that after you've settle down and into the shamatha, then Vipassana arises from that. But in another sense, you're saying it was there all along.
Didn't we, at the very beginning of the course, didn't we read these neat interchanges of him teaching meditation instructors?
Yeah, I think we did.
Where was that? I'm lost in this big book here. Who put this together?
You need to teach it to talk to you.
I'm here. There it is.
You need to talk to the guy in the road.
Where is that? Early teacher training, 109 to 112, right? That would be neat to see, where people are asking him, like, so where, how do we introduce... Oh, now my pages are out of order. I forgot about that.
Oh, yeah, that's a great book. Early teacher's training.
Yeah.
Right?
Processing identifying the breath is something in space.
So on 109, you don't divide thoughts into sections. You guys, 109?
Yeah.
But follow a more general process. You don't verbalize your thoughts. You don't teach the calmness of mind. So he's talking to teachers, right? Instead, you pay attention to the acute precision of the breath, the outgoing breath without verbal labels. So you're dropping... thinking label, the labeling of thinking. That's secret. Don't you're not supposed to know that. With the teach out breath, the in breath is considered only for turning, only the turning for the next out breath. That term turning is, anyway, it's like the lingo in the tradition. Eyes are open. Vipassana is the process of identifying with the breath dissolving in space, has the acute precision of breathing from the nostrils. And here he presents, see the order he presents here? Shamatha, Vipassana, Shamatha, Vipassana. Okay. And then, where's 110? Is that the other way?
the other techniques are all forms of attention to the breath and the person is conscious of the journey, something we were talking about before, that emotion of journey. Four foundations of mindfulness, the third one you wanted to.
Oh well, I'm remembering something else. I'll bring that. Where he talks about how to point out Vipassana practice. Anyway, I think he talked a little bit about it in this talk, so let's continue with this guy. 186, right? No? Yeah, comparison.
We're going back to where we were?
Yeah.
190 or something? Or 186?
186. So there's any contemplative approach is Vipassana, pondering on the subject of Dharma intellectuals, Vipassana practice. Moreover, there's the meditative practice of Vipassana, which is development of awareness. And this might remind you of the different types of prajna, which are traditionally three, right? There's the prajna of, what's the first prajna?
Talking about hearing?
Hearing. And then contemplating and meditating, right? So Vipassana has the same quality of having these different stages or characteristics similar to those stages of Vipassana because Vipassana is the way to cultivate prajna. He talks about the definition of Dharma. Next page, the last paragraph. The technique or means of developing Vipassana practice is exactly the same. Here it is, what I just quoted. Yeah. The same as we discussed the other day. The third foundational mindfulness effort.
Where are you now?
I'm on the last paragraph of 187. Is that right? With a sudden glimpse of awareness which brings us back, unconditioned awareness which brings us back to the practice. So that's the technique of Vipassana, right? And you remember this from the talk on the third foundation of mindfulness. Let's see, 234. In the case of right effort, the main technique that is developed is constantly bringing oneself back. When our mind begins to wander, we begin to realize it and then bring it back on 232. The interesting point of bringing back it is you don't have to prepare and hold and drag back as if you're trying to prevent a naughty child from doing something terrible and dragging it back. The thing about this effort is that some kind of trick is involved as far as the sitting practice of meditation is concerned. When I say trick, it's a technique that is extremely effective and useful, not only at the time of sitting, but also day-to-day living situations post-meditation. Instead of trying to bring back by deliberate effort, back to the body, back to the consciousness, hear me, that seems to be going against the general rhythm of the expanding, going out with the breath. And that type of bringing back is the shamatha, bringing back, right? It seems to be directly contradictory. It's not a question of bringing back from that point of view, but bringing back in a sense of bringing down from the dream world into reality. You're breathing, you're sitting, and that's what you're doing, and you should be doing that completely, fully, wholeheartedly. But there's a way to do that which we might call the abstract watcher. The watcher doesn't have an aim or a goal. The watcher is just being aware of itself. The sudden flash of the watcher being there. You don't think in terms of, I must get back to the breath, I must try and get away from these thoughts. You don't have to have a concrete, logical mind to repeat to itself the purpose of practice. There's a general sense that something's happening here and you're brought back suddenly, even without a name, even without an idea why, how, where, just a quick voice of changing the tone. So that's the core of right mindfulness practice, which is the technique of Vipassana practice.
Sounds like labeling.
There's a little bit of a jerk. Almost.
At first, but then when you're used to it, it's not as jerky.
Yeah. You sort of come back, but the
not
usually the when you come back ordinarily, it's I've been away. But this is you just come back.
What if you back come back too much and you get like overshoot?
Like in those space movies.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
One of the subtleties of the practice, so I'm back on 187, is that one could still apply exactly the same method of meditation practice to be used in shamatha. One can use breathing, but in this case, instead of being mindfulness of breathing, it becomes awareness of breathing. Awareness of breathing in this case means that there's a sense of precision, accuracy, which is what he usually describes, how he usually describes mindfulness, right? Precision, accuracy. But also there's a sense of accommodating in that one doesn't have to nurse the experience of being mindful constantly. So you don't have to keep, you don't have to take care of it all the time. You don't have to preserve it. Like there's, like in shamatha, it's like the, making sure that it doesn't disperse. And then with awareness, there's this sense of confidence that it can't disperse. In the case of mindfulness, we still tend to trust a great deal in the messenger, which brings back the message of what's happening. The messenger checks the sense of totality and well-being. The sense of thisness is still happening, rather than otherness. That seems to be the difference between the two. In the case of shamatha, some kind of importance is still made on thisness, in spite of going out with the out-breath, dissolving oneself into the atmosphere. Still it belongs to this area rather than the other or that. In the case of Vipassana, there's less emphasis on this, and there's a very subtle and faint emphasis on some kind of security and letting go, letting be. Security in the sense of confidence that you can let go and let be. Are you okay? The other is more important. The other what?
The second one, letting be.
The other what?
Type of.
Instead of this, it's that. The other is that. Right? Mixing mind with what?
That.
That. Other. We can afford to let go more with the breathing. Do you remember in the beginning we discussed that the shamatha practice is purely related with the verge of breathing, the outline of breathing, a light touch. In Vipassana, it's slightly more than that, not more in the sense of letting go of your breathing, mindfulness of breathing or awareness of breathing, making it much looser and more casual, but in the sense that the attitude to the breathing has the otherness involved. If you aren't confused, you should be, right? What the hell is he talking about? But in this, so he says, it's not more in the sense of letting go of your breathing, mindfulness of breathing or awareness of breathing, making it much looser and more casual. It's not that kind of letting go, making it more casual.
Like more accepting, letting it be.
Allow. But in the sense, the attitude to the breathing has the otherness involved. The space. Right? we've mixed our minds with space, and so we have a sense of that spaciousness all the time as being there, and it's not being some distraction, like going away somewhere. Okay, you have an awfully funny look.
It's almost like, I keep thinking like with mindfulness, it's like you have to be careful you don't bump into anything. Mm. But with awareness, there's no bumping into anything.
It's fun to bump into things.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just, it's not, it's like they're just there. And
yeah.
You're not bumping into them.
Yeah, you're naturally just like avoiding them or
not.
Yeah.
Well, just, it sounds, it's also sort of just reducing the sense of separation.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the awareness, it's just, you're not bumping into it because it's not really,
it's not
separate.
Right.
Yeah. It's a continuous,
you've already
continuous
bumped
sense.
You're bumping into yourself.
Right. So instead of relating to the objects, you're relating to the path that goes through the objects.
Okay.
Or just the experience, not objectified.
So the breathing happens not only in its own accord, but also in the realm of the atmosphere around the breathing. When we talk about the otherness, we're talking about the sense of atmosphere, the sense of totality completely outside of our body and completely outside of the antenna's radiation. So the sense of going beyond your conceptual framework, your limiting sense of space. Skipping the question, he said, in the second sense, if a person has a really good understanding of the shamatha practice in its own sense of space, then vipassana practice becomes much easier to work with. In some sense, the difference between the two practices of meditation is that shamatha is extraordinarily literal. In spite of its visions, its feelings, its sense of inspiration and discipline, it is very literal. Vipassana is somewhat romantic in a way, idealistic. There's room for some kind of ventilation or fresh air. Quite possibly a person of early Vipassana practice. How about early Vipassana practice person? Who is used to shamatha practice would feel extremely guilty about that for doing something unkosher. I don't know, at some point, if you haven't encountered that, I think you will, in that it's like you have this shamatha practice that you're being very diligent about, very careful and cultivating, and at a certain point, no matter how hard you try, it's like you can't maintain that level of disciplined, close, precise shamatha practice. It's like dissolving, and it feels like you can't meditate anymore. Something's coming from, I don't know, at least that's the other people.
And you might start by thinking that's a problem.
Right, you start by thinking it's unkosher.
Isn't that sort of like when at some point you just don't want to look down anymore, you want to look out, and it happens naturally.
Yes. But at first it's unsettling. It's like,
right, it's like you're breaking the rules.
Yeah.
Down.
Yeah.
I had a meditation instructor and doctor that kept saying, do you ever want to lift up your gaze? I said, no. I was a good Catholic boy. You always have to.
Yeah.
Have you never lift up? No.
That's hilarious. That's great. So that's one of the indications is where your gaze is. You know, we start, you know, down here. We're told, oh, I got to do it right there, right? And we're very literal at the beginning. I got to do it right, you know. And a lot of us, you know, would like ask lots of questions, like, you know, where, like, am I supposed to, you know, be very precise? And then gradually, you know, as John is saying, gradually you raise the gaze. It's encouraging.
Then there might
questions.
Be the non-Catholics who might talk.
Oh!
Yeah, I'm just saying, probably other people who kind of come from a rule-breaking point of view, let's
yeah.
say, like, you know, artists or non-Catholics or whatever.
Well, there were people who would just be sitting, like,
it's like, why do I have to keep my eyes open? Why do I have to do this? Why do I have to do that?
Yeah.
People do that, too. I mean, you know, they ask some people, they challenge all of this.
True. But that is just a kind of hesitation, like when at a public swimming pool, you don't want to undress. That's amazing. How does he know that experience? although you have swimming suits available and you can put one on, still even that's regarded as a paint. Amazing example. Actually, it's deliberately designed that way. First there's shamatha practice to lighten up the whole thing, make it into a really definite...
Tighten up?
Tighten up. Thank you. Thank you. I knew that didn't sound right. Tighten up the whole thing. Make it into a really definite ordinary, an ordinary thing. Beyond that, you try to let go of any notion of inhibition, product of that practice of meditation, while still retaining the heart of the practice, which is to say that a sense of precision is still carried over, but a sense of freedom is added onto it. After we have practiced shamatha meditation, from then onward, up to tantra practices, most of the techniques are letting go techniques of all kinds. We think we've been letting go completely, but we find because of the dogma that we were involved in, that we've been keeping something private, personal. And we find something to let go of constantly each time, each practice that we're involved in, shunyatama, mahamudra, whatever. We're very, conscientious, most of us, you know. I'm supposed to do this, you know. So I don't know how many of you meet with meditation instructors, but I encourage you to do that, because that's where this sort of pointing out of how to advance in the practice can happen in a very skillful, individual, helpful way. You know, so if you don't meet with a meditation instructor ever, I encourage you to.
The interesting thing is that letting go and all of that is it gets into, the giving up the goal orientation. Because if you have an instruction, then you can try to achieve it.
Right.
You know, but if you have, you know, every time you let go of those things, they're like,
where am I going? What am I doing?
How am I going to know if I did it?
You expect it to be natural, don't you? For it to come from the inside, dawn.
Well, that's what that's the jargon. To be honest with you, we say that it happens naturally, but I think it's very helpful for it to be provoked. Because I think otherwise, a lot of people will spend years making their shamatha even better and better and better and get very uptight about it. I don't know.
Right.
And
no
then
view.
It's very helpful to have somebody to do, you know, what John said, you sure you would never raise your gaze, you know, or like relax a little bit in your posture. In a sense, Vipassana also brings an appreciation of art, in the sense of how to handle ourselves in body, speech, and mind, and so forth. There's a sense of being resulting from shamatha practice, and there's also the confident sense of how to be, as well, resulting from Vipassana. So it's like the shamatha sense of being is very mindful, you know, in terms of inward sensation of keeping track of where we are, not bumping into things, very circumspect, you know. And then the Vipassana experience is a bit more relaxed. So the practice of Vipassana is more the study of movements or interactions. Sitting practice relates with the breathing, it's felt. You go out with your breath and breathing dissolves, you dissolve. There's also a sense of some kind of echo. Not exactly a moderator, but a sense of an echo. You've developed your mindfulness practice, you breathe out, I'm breathing out. Being mindful of that. And then at the same time you're aware of your mindfulness, so there's a kind of delayed action of going out and going out. Dissolve and dissolve, space and space. And then going out and going out. There's some kind of shadow created by Vipassana practice, which is almost on the level of verbalization of feeling that it's happening, it's happening. It's not a confirmation, but just a remark, a careless remark that sees things. So I encourage you to read that paragraph over and over again.
It's frustrating.
There was something else that I meant to come back to. The watcher, it was in the third mindfulness, the abstract watcher dawns. The sense of You know, so when he says abstract watcher, he's distinguishing it from the initial stage of the watcher, i.e. the non-abstract, the sort of literal watcher that's seen, you know, is my posture right, am I with the breath, am I labeling on? And the abstract watcher is like the watcher that's there before you realize that you could be aware, before you've come back, that watcher was there the whole time. And it doesn't have like a place or an agenda or there's no commentary of that abstract watcher.
So that's the echo? That's the shadow?
Yeah. Or the shadow and the echo like point out that abstract watcher. In other words, mindfulness is a very serious thing. If you have awareness with mindfulness, you begin to see the seriousness of mindfulness. Your mindfulness is also lightened by it. It becomes much lighter, less heavy. But it doesn't become completely free and careless, because you're still continuing your practice on the one base of basic training, basic practice. So this letting go that happens in Vipassana practice is not careless. It's not just like this total carefree, free-for-all type thing. You can't develop a completely freestyle of practice outside the technique. The whole thing is still boring and technical in some sense. That kind of secondary spokesperson, secondary mindfulness, which is awareness, allows the possibility of extending ourselves to greater awareness. And in this case, we're not discussing any of, you know, all these other advanced things. We haven't gone to the level of advancing enough or playing it about enough. At this point, we're just discussing the little shadow, the light shadow that goes along with your mindfulness. That is what is known as awareness practice. It's the shadow, right? The shadow knows. Wasn't there a radio show, The Shadow?
Yeah.
And we learn how to handle ourselves, how to work, because the whole thing is no longer awkward. With a one-shot deal, it becomes very awkward. But since there is a one-shot deal, as well as a soft landing of a secondary something, it allows us at least to be less awkward. The function of early Vipassana practice is to make one less awkward. I think I've talked enough about this.
And then he says, as far as technique, it's identical with the Anapanasati practice.
I know I skipped that.
Yeah.
As far as technique, it's identical with the Anapanasati practice of coming and going with the breath, the same thing.
It's pretty bizarre.
It's like a little non sequitur for people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, just sitting here noticing. Yeah.
It's funny because on one hand he's been saying, you know, different, you would almost think that it's more shamatha than Vipassana, so that raises another question.
Okay, so then go on, let's see, source text, page 114, sorry.
114?
Yeah. A couple more things real quick. I'm a little confused about, so it's not the source book, no, sorry, the source text. So just a couple of, it's the third page of, thank you, on the very bottom. I'm a little confused about exactly what the practice is. Is the practice itself to see the shadow or let go of the shadow? You got that? That's 193?
Yeah.
Thanks. See the shadow and disown it. That's the same practice as we were discussing about the third mindfulness practice of awareness. It comes to you and you just be with it, but disown it. It's the same thing. That will always be used for the technique of all practices. Any techniques, any particular tricks we might use for meditation practice are not regarded as something we should hang on to, but rather take advantage of and then throw it away. And you never lose it, it comes back to you. Can't get rid of it. Throw it away and it comes back. That's the biggest trick of mindfulness. And then here's the interesting part. In LA, didn't you talk about Vipassana as panoramic awareness? And he says, yeah, we haven't gotten to that yet. let's see. Let's see, 196. Where were we? 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 197. So the first questionnaire is going to have a question about abstract effort. At the end of that question, the person says, it seems that it would just happen while we're doing our breathing. Where does the separation between shamatha and vipassana happen? Let's get really precise about this. And the shamatha vipassana happens at the level of... I love the way the person interrupts him.
Yeah.
No! Although you never know. Sometimes he would just space out. No, I mean between the end of shamatha and the beginning of vipassana.
Oh,
come on, Rinpoche, be really precise here for a change. Yeah, it happens in the level of sort of a new level, in the level of a sort of a new basic attitude that there is a sudden abstract flash and then faithfully holding back the shamatha, or else the sense of the shadow that we've been talking about. It's not quite going back, way back, but halfway through, making use of that flash and not trying to go right back. It's approaching from the outer realm rather than the inner realm. As far as, it's like turning the light around from the outside, right? As far as the flash is concerned, there's no difference at all. In fact, the Vipassana type flashes of awareness have to grow out of the shamatha type at the beginning. The early parts of your Vipassana practice will be still shamatha type awareness, but then you begin to realize that there's a different approach already that is so seated to the unconscious mind, that is so seated, and begin to create another type of flash, which is Vipassana type, but that probably happens much later. Anyway, so I think
you
that's
have to
it.
Go to the punch line.
Yeah, the punch line. The punch bowl, maybe.
These are shadows coming from subconsciousness. Something like that, I would say. Yeah.
Okay, how about one last thing on the page?
You can write that down.
That's good. Where were we? What page were we on? 199. Two more pages. Right in the middle. Yeah, the question says, yeah. Rinpoche says, well, you see, in the beginning practice of meditation, it's not so much that I'm going to meditate and I'm going to sit and what can I do, but you have to develop some sense of being yourself. And in many cases, when people come for a first interview, I don't give them breathing technique, but I just ask them to sit. And usually what happens is they find it very difficult to just sit. And they ask, what else can I do apart from just sitting? So he's explaining to this person. This person's complaining about the technique, and they wanted to do this other open version. A lot of people get frightened. Let's see. They ask, what else can I do? And the technique is just brought about from that level. A lot of people get frightened or put off by a set technique. It becomes too mechanical if you present it at the beginning without them having gone through that. And there are all kinds of implications like that involved. Rather than just relating with themselves, I think that's been the case for a lot of people who didn't receive the technique to meditate on anything. It was just to, so to speak, lure them into the meditation. So that's a little, you know, on the lines of our historical commentary on how Rinpoche brought people along in practice, where initially he didn't give them any technique. And then he wanted them to do the real technique, and they were like, oh, I'm above that, why do I have to do that? By this merit,
may
it defeat from the storm and waves of birth, old age, sickness and death, from the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings by the confidence of the golden sun of the great east. May the lotus garden of the Raitan's wisdom bloom. May the dark ignorance of sentient beings be dispelled. May all beings enjoy profound, brilliant glory.